York City. New York City. Welcome to our podcast, American Masters, Lennon NYC, Beyond Broadcast. I'm Susan Lacey, the creator and executive producer of American Masters and a producer on Lennon NYC. And with me is our film's director, Michael Epstein.
Hello, hello.
So, Michael, tell us what's going to happen today.
Today is the second half of Elephant's Memory podcast, Adam Ippolito. And Adam was the keyboard player for Elephant's Memory, and a very, very wry, funny guy. I think it's a great interview. I think, you know, he's got sort of wonderful insight into John and Yoko, and that's it. I hope you enjoy it. Okay. Next week's going to be a interesting one.
Well, thanks, Michael. And, well, do join us next week when our podcast is going to consist of a special set of interviews that we did on John's childhood in Liverpool, which didn't actually make the film, but they're great interviews.
Yeah, we did a bunch of them. We did some with John's cousins. We did with somebody who runs John's childhood home now, which is part of the National Trust, Mendips. We did some with the quarrymen. There was a time when we all thought we were going to touch on Liverpool in the film, and that just kind of never happened. So we thought we would, unlike these, give you the sort of cut-down versions, maybe greatest hits of Liverpool, maybe we'll call it that way. So that's next week.
Okay. And, well, thank you again, Michael. And make sure you watch Lennon NYC on the PBS series American Masters, November 22nd. But do check your local listings. And to find out more, go to www.pbs.org/AmericanMasters.
Well, the village was, you know, before it became, well, you know, let's face it, in the 50s it was a beatnik haven. So it's always been, you know, for artists. And even before that, when I moved to the village and when, you know, John got to New York, it was starting to really, really turn into an artist haven again. Because what happened was, you know, a lot of older people started to move out or die off. And it gave the opportunity for a lot of young people to move in. I remember my first apartment in the village was, I think, $135 a month in 1973. So that was pretty cheap back then.
Yeah.
Uptown was twice as much.
Jess, go ahead. Is that my phone?
I'm just looking because I want to turn off the radio.
Yeah, I think it's mine, unfortunately.
Okay. Which is where?
It should be right there on the counter. It's green. Sorry, I'll yell at the director.
No, yeah, exactly. You're fired.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. So, I mean, and it's not particularly stuffy.
No, it's not stuffy at all. I mean, you know, you had Rosa, what was her name? Well, it was the kind of place where you had a lot of people who were different that didn't fit into the norm. And we had a Rollerina, I think her name was. You know, she used to ride around the village on her roller skates and a fairy outfit. And you had, back then, we even had Moondog. I don't know if you remember him. He was the guy who used to stand on 52nd Street outside of the CBS building and give, you know, talk poetry. Or.
And Ginsberg, right?
Yeah, Ginsberg was there. Everybody was, you know, still very happening, you know.
Abby, Jerry.
Yeah. Well, actually, some people still lived up on the west side. But, you know, the village was kind of where you wanted to hang anyway.
In a political time, too, right? I mean, it's not...
Oh, yeah, very political.
Talk to me if you can.
Well...
You were like the Republican in the midst, right? You guys were all the conservative part of...
No, we weren't too conservative. We were pretty radical for back then.
What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that we were the movement band. We played, you know, the Columbia riots. We played the NYU demonstrations. We played Impeach Nixon. We did May Day in Washington. You know, whenever there was a rally or a benefit, we were there. So that's how we got hooked up with Jerry Rubin and people like that. And it was Jerry that introduced us to John Lennon.
Okay. So, and you're playing what kind of music? You're playing salsa?
Playing hard rock. But all very political hard rock. I mean, everything we did was political. You know, everything was, moving through the midnight. Hang on, let me think of the words now. Busting through the jailhouse walls, watch my brothers fight. Tear gas, it makes my eyes run, but it don't make me cry. The only thing that hurts me is to see my brothers die. Yeah, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. And then lots of guitar, lots of, you know, sound, and lots of protest. I mean, we weren't commercial, but we were very, you know, political.
And did it hurt you that you weren't commercial? Did you care about it? Or was it politics, really the forefront?
The politics were the forefront for us. Did we want to have a hit? Yeah. But didn't always work out. We had a hit called Mongoose, which was about the cobra and the mongoose and how the mongoose is able to kill the cobra. There was a little bit of a metaphor in there. And then we did something called Skyscraper Commando, which was in the top five around the country in all the test markets, but got pulled by the FCC because we said he buys dope with welfare checks. And at that point, the FCC took it off the air. So we could have had a hit maybe, but we told ourselves we didn't want to have a hit. You know, we were an underground band.
Against the man.
Yeah, of course. Right. Yeah. Rip off the judge, rip off the jail, you know. We were ripping off the mail, everything, you know.
I love this stuff. And you guys also
Cowboys?
Midnight Cowboys.
Oh, yeah. We did a couple of songs for Midnight Cowboy, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we were also, one night we were playing down at the Anderson Theater, which was across from the Fillmore. And we were on the bill with Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry. And you know, so we were, I think we opened, Bo Diddley came on, and then we played for Chuck Berry also. And the...
Pepe, you're in the frame. Sorry. Okay, Pepe, we'll cut for a second. Come on in. Pepe? Mike, you got all that whipped cream?
Or do you have anything that will absorb, that he can hold in his hand?
Yeah.
All right.
You got one for your leader?
This is what I'm going to do, because this doesn't...
We're done. Locking down? Rolling? Okay. All right. So, you do paint a nice picture of a kind of... Like, the thing about the Village that I think people don't understand is that... And this is true for New York, I think, even still today, is that they're communities. I know a shitload of people at Cobble Hill, and you think that I live in some kind of small town in Iowa, almost, because they're my neighbors, I see the guys in the street, I know the fishmonger. It's like a Welsh village,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was true for you guys in the village?
Oh, in the Village, yeah. I mean, you knew people because it was a neighborhood. You knew the people in the neighborhood, so it was kind of a family kind of thing in the Village. I knew this guy. I knew the guy who lived in the vacant lot in the shed, you know, and had the dogs, and you knew all the characters. And, you know, we were all just living there.
Yeah. But also, none of you guys are, you know, Marines. You're not, you know, none of these, you're all sort of a certain political persuasion.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, we were very politically involved, and that was our bent that back then. You know, we were very involved politically.
So is it when John and Yoko show up, and, I mean, you know, the things that I've heard people say is, rumor starts to float around that they're seen, you know, riding their bikes around through the village and stuff. How did you get a sense that John had landed in New York?
How did I know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I knew he was in New York, to tell you the truth. I probably did, but it wasn't something, you know, in my consciousness at that point. I mean, I wasn't really a Beatles fan, you know, but I learned to love them. I was a jazzer as a kid, and then when I got into rock and roll, I was more into blues and the Animals and the Stones. But I appreciated the Beatles a lot.
Right. Whenever you put that down, just so that we can get the rustle.
Okay.
It's fine. The hand moving your hands is off the camera. It's fine. Okay.
Sorry.
Roger get mad at me later. He's already looking at me
with
the evil eye.
I really wanted to hear him talking about the difference between the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and then he was making that noise, and I was
lost.
Going crazy.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. If he could do that again, I would like to hear that clean.
Okay. I don't think I can do it.
Could you be able to
right. Yeah, okay.
But you know, the thing about Elephant's memory, and I think this is really important, is that it's not just that it's a political band, but you guys have a very particular sound. And it's a sound that John immediately loved.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, when John heard the band, he was like, wow, these guys are perfect for me. Why? Number one, we were political. Number two, we were a rough rock and roll band. We were a hard rock and roll band. Number three, he was actually surprised that we could write our own songs. You know, he was happy about that because he wound up producing us. So he liked the fact that we had our own material.
But you know, it's the sound, and when people hear a rough rock and roll band, when I think of like Stan's sax playing, right?
Right.
Or something, and I think of Texas guitar. You guys have a particular kind of 50s rock and roll almost. I mean,
right.
Louder, more aggressive.
Right.
But
well, you know, we all grew up during the 50s. I mean, all of us, we were all born in the 40s, so we lived through the 50s. And you couldn't live through the 50s without being influenced by Elvis and everything else that happened. Even though I was the grandson and son of a musician, I still wound up listening to Elvis, you know, much to my father's chagrin. But, you know, he said, what is this? I said, it's rock and roll, Dad, you know. And I remember the first time I saw Elvis, I said, wow, why is everybody screaming? I was young, you know, I didn't understand what was going on, but I knew everybody was screaming, so either he was doing something great or something really wrong. I couldn't figure it out at the time, but he was shaking, you know, and everything, and
and that's what you wanted to be.
That's what, I wanted to play for him anyway. Actually, I did play him in high school. They did some show, they made me be Elvis, you know.
But did John connect with you guys? I mean, the politics aside for just a second.
Musically, absolutely.
Talk to me if you can about that, because this is a guy who's not just, he's a historian, right? I mean, he loves all of this stuff.
Yeah, well, the whole British explosion grew out of American blues and rock and roll, obviously. So yes, they love that. That to them was how they connected, you know. Mick Jagger would be walking down the street with some blues albums, and he sees Keith Richards and says, hey, blah, 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 where did you get those? Oh, then they become friends. And that's what connected us. We were all into the same type of music, including John. You know, really hard rock, 50. I mean, John idolized Elvis. Elvis was his man. He really loved Elvis.
How do you know that?
Well, he told me. And he told us, and he yelled it out in concert. I love you, Elvis. You know, and I mean, we even did
Hound Dog,
right? Yep, we did Hound Dog.
Off the cuff.
Yeah, no, we had played it before.
You had played it before?
Yeah. Oops.
No, you can
drink.
So, Jerry connects you to John. How does that happen?
Okay.
You're like a sort of house protest band.
Yeah, right. We, you know, we were always did our own thing, but always was involved with the movement. So one day we're down in the village at the place where we rehearsed, and we're waiting to rehearse, and Rick, our drummer, didn't show up. So we're, you know, usually waiting for somebody. We're musicians. And finally Rick calls after 2 hours and says, and I got the call. I said, you know, where are you? He says, I'm at the Hit Factory, or the record plant, with Jerry Rubin and John Lennon. I said, yeah, right. Come down. We're very angry. It's time to rehearse. He said, seriously, I'm here with John Lennon. I said, okay. He said, he's going to come down tonight. He's looking for a band. So that was very exciting. You know. So then we all like went over to Texas House and did what we do and, you know, just couldn't believe it. So a couple hours later, we show up at the Magna Graphics, which was the studio, and I'm walking up to the door, and here comes John and Yoko. And I looked at him, I said, are you you? He says, yeah, are you you? You know, so he had that wit. And that's how we met him. And then we went inside, we started to play. And the most amazing thing, besides the birth of my first son, was hearing John Lennon's voice singing rock and roll while I was playing. I mean, that was pretty amazing, you know? I mean, a voice that I had grown up with, hearing anyway, you know?
Give me a sense of why that voice was so great.
Well, because, you know, you're hearing the voice of your generation in your ear while you're playing. A musician's perspective?
What makes John such a great rock and roll singer? Unless you think he's a shitty rock and roll singer.
No, he was a great rock and roll singer. It was his voice. His voice and his feeling. I mean, music is feeling. It's all passion. So if you can display that and work it through your body and get it out, that's what it's all about. That's why people connect to certain singers, because of their passion and their ability to communicate. And that's what John had.
Yeah, there's a rawness to
Oh, yeah. Well, John was really the lead singer of the Beatles, if you think about it. And listen, Paul was more the soloist. When they did the rock songs, John was singing lead. When they did the ballads and this and that, then Paul sang. He sang, I mean, he did sing...
Skelter.
Yeah, and he sang Dizzy Miss Lizzy or whatever, you know, a lot of things. But John was, if you look at pictures and videos, John was on one mic and George and Paul were on the other mic, because John was the lead singer. He had a great rock voice.
It's a voice that just cuts through everything.
Well, you know, he had that edge to his voice. And he had a very specific sound. You know, whether it was the way he sang through his nose or bypassed his nose, whatever it was just a very, very unique voice. So hearing it while I'm playing was like, you know, amazing. And in fact, we were playing, and at one point he looks at me and goes like this. And I realized that I'm playing there, and I'm like, oh. So he looked and gave me the face, you know. And then I realized I have to start being cool, yeah. You know. Yeah.
He's got a great sense of humor, too.
Oh, excellent, yeah.
Give me some sense, though, what it's like to play with him as a musician. I mean, I think that in all of the political conversation, all the things, one of the things I want to try to teach out of this is later on, after that jam session, when you guys are either recording, he's either producing you or you're recording sometime in New York City.
Right.
What makes him a great rhythm guitar player? What makes him a great songwriter in your mind?
Well, rhythm guitar. He's a great rhythm guitar player. Rhythm guitar is very important because you have to know what to play and what not to play. You know, it's the feel of the song. It's what makes, besides the drums. Obviously, you can't have rock and roll without drums. But after the drums, that rhythm guitar really lays down where you're going, the way you're going. You know, whether it be like a lot of upstrokes, you know, like a funky thing, or you know, something like that. Whatever he did, he did it well as a rhythm guitar player.
And John's rhythm, what made John's rhythm stand out for you? Or was it just kind of common, just kind of technically proficient?
It had nothing to do with technique. It was all feeling with him. And he was playing for so long. He was so experienced as a rhythm guitarist that, you know, it just was natural for him. I mean, I got to play with him with that Rickenbacker that you see in all those early Beatle photos, you know, and see him with that standing there. It was great.
And John is a songwriter. When you guys were cutting sometime in New York City, he was coming in with fully finished songs. And how did he work in the studio?
Well, the way he worked was he would come in and take me into a room, and he would sing the song and play guitar. And basically, he would come in with a lyric sheet. And I would sit at the piano and figure out what the chords were as he played it. Excuse me. Cut.
We'll edit that.
Yeah, you know how to edit, right?
Okay. Exactly. Right. So he comes in, tell him.
All right.
Let's start.
Oh, yeah, so he comes in, I go into the piano, and he starts playing the song. You know, whatever it might have been. A woman is the nigga of the world, right? And then I write down the chords as he's playing it, where they should fall. I mean, obviously, John didn't write music. He didn't know how to write music or read music. But most rock and roll people don't. How to read and write. But we never actually wrote the music down anyway. We just wrote the chords down where they belonged. You know, and either mostly
chord
with
progression.
Yeah, chord progression, right? Whether it was a chord progression, let me say. In other words, we would figure out only where the chords fell rhythmically. You know, we didn't write. Sometimes, for the other guys, I would write out a chord chart, what we call it, so you could read it down as you're going. But basically, honestly, the songs were not that difficult, so we could just, you know, play them from our heads after learning them.
And did he have an understanding of where all the instrumentation was going to be, what he was going to be hearing, or did you guys organically find that as a band? That's, I'm trying to think of this, like, you know, there's a bootleg that I have heard of John about to rip into New York City, sometime in New York City, and he's like, okay, I'm ready, you know, more bass in the phones, and then he's like, okay, I'm ready to go, but I know you're going to make this some clean fucking thing that I hate. You know, I forget exactly the phrase. I don't know if you've ever heard the bootleg of it, but he's like...
What's this the bootleg of?
It's a bootleg, it's just before he starts ripping into a cut of New York City. I don't know which take it is.
Oh, okay. Oh, you mean from a rehearsal?
Yeah, I mean, he's doing a take of it for the album.
Okay.
And he's like, you're going to make it to that clean, clean fucking sound that I just hate, but let's go anyway. Because he's got the sense that he wants it as raw.
Absolutely.
Talk to me.
Yeah, okay, John liked it. He liked to have it be very fresh. We only would do one take. I can't remember that we did two takes, maybe once in a while. But usually everything was done in one take because he didn't want it to get stale. And he's right. After you start to play a song, it becomes stale. If you notice, really good groups sound much better live than they do on record, or they sound as good or better. Because when you're live, you're playing with all your emotion. And you try to do that when you're recording too. But when you're in the 5th and the 10th and the 12th and the 15th take, you're going to lose that fire.
That's what he did with the Beatles. I mean, they would take and do take after take.
Well, that was a different... That was
overdubbing and all sorts of stuff.
Yes, well, we overdubbed. That wasn't a problem. But the basic rhythm track, he wanted that to be fresh. He wanted it to feel like it was live. And if you do anything over and over and over, you know, it becomes routine, and that happens with a song very quickly.
Yeah, he talks also about the Sometime in New York City album as being ripped from the headline. Or just having it feel very much like...
Right, and that's why he put...
What's the idea of the album?
Okay, the album was basically a newspaper, and it was about current events. Everything in there, including the pictures on the album, were set up to look like a newspaper and a current one at that. So you had Nixon and... was it Mao dancing, right, in the nude, of course.
Give me that name, right?
Yeah. He wanted it to be, where was it? Let me see.
He wanted it like you're picking up the New York Times.
Right. He wanted it to be, like a newspaper. So you had pictures of Mao and Nixon dancing in the nude. That alone should have had the record banned from the stores, but somehow we got that through. And then he had pictures of the people who he was singing about, like John Sinclair and Attica State. He had pictures in reference to all the songs. Yeah, for him it was a journal of what was going through his mind at the time and what he felt needed fixing and what he wanted to let the world know about.
And it's not, and the interesting thing for me creatively, artistically, is yes, the songs are very political and there's that, but the musical approach is as immediate as it's coming off the wire, going to write the story, and it's going to just put out there. So if there's typos, if there's something, if the harmony isn't quite right, that's all, it's all about just the absolute intimacy and immediacy getting out. Were you guys talking about that? You guys like say, hey, you know, John, let's go back, we can do that song a little bit better with a little bit more studio.
Well, we found working with John that he liked to work in one take. Not everybody is like that. A lot of people are very, very, they're perfectionists in that they want to get every note and everything exactly right. That's not really rock and roll. Because if you listen to the rest rock and roll bands, they're always a little out of tune, somebody makes a mistake, they drop a beat. That's what was great about the Stones and, you know, the Animals and all those really raw rock and roll bands. And I think that perhaps after working with the Beatles for so many, for 10 years, and with George Martin and really building epic records, I think that it was an approach for him to just do it raw, do it right the first time, and if not, go with it anyway. Because that's as fresh as it's ever going to be.
Did you get the sense that he was trying to escape that shadow just a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I think that not only was John trying to escape the shadow of the Beatles, but in competition with that. You know, whenever we did something, he was kind of thinking about, well, Paul did Give Ireland Back to the Irish, and now we've done Sunday Bloody Sunday, but we're going to do Woman's Is the Negro of the World, and we're going to beat Paul to the woman's issue. Okay, so there were a lot of dynamics involved in the writing and the performing of the songs.
When you guys got the first moment that night, John Brock, Woman Is the Negro of the World, into the studio, you remember that?
Sure, very well.
So talking to you, like, John, you can't say that?
Well, I said, you know, I mean, I guess you're a Beatle. I guess you can say these things, you know, what's up, you know.
What was your response? What was your first take before you said anything? What was your...
Well, you know, we went through the usual thing. John came in with the lyrics, and we went into the room to the piano, and he said, here's the song, and he started strumming. Woman is the nigger of the world. And I said, what? It's woman is the nigger of the world. Wow, that's amazing. You're going to say that? He said, yeah. All right. You know, it's not my band. No problem, you know. We had our own problems with those kind of lyrics. So he put it out, and, you know, unfortunately it wasn't a hit because I don't think most of the radio stations would play it. And we got taken off the air for using dope as a lyric. So, you know, putting a nigger, you can't even say that today.
So, what do you think
that with all due respect.
You can say it, you know,
okay.
It's PBS.
What was he trying to say? He was trying to say that women were as put down as African Americans, and maybe even more so, because they've always been put down since the beginning of mankind. You know,
and that message gets lost, though.
Yeah, because you know what people hear is nigger, and they don't understand. They thought it was a racist lyric. You know, well, most people don't think. Let's face it. You know, 95% of the people in the world don't really think, and that's why we can make a living. But you know, this people get, you know, they get off on what they hear, and they don't really think about it sometimes, you know. And that was a big problem. Interesting, when we were doing that song, he was playing it. When he went into the bridge, and sang, we make her paint her face and dance. One, two, three, one. Make her paint her face and dance. And I said, John, hang on one second. Can you play that again? And he played it again, and this time he did it in 4/4, because that first time he played it in 3/4. So I said, wait a minute now, is it 3/4? Now it's a 4/4. He said, what? I said, play it again. So he said, we make her paint her face and dance, 2, 3, 1, we make her paint. I said, that's it, yeah, let's do that, because that's hip. You know, you did that on, we could work it out. You went into that point where it was a 3/4 time. So he was a creator, but we kind of worked as editors and arrangers with him. You know,
cool.
That's what we did. We were rangers to the point where, you know, some of the guys started to tell him what to do too much, and that was the end.
Exactly.
You know.
Now, were you upset with the political nature of the album? Did you think Bloody Sunday and Angela and, you know, Sisters, Oh Sisters? You thinking like?
No, he was preaching to the choir. We were there. I mean, our album was the same. You know, everything we did was like that. So we didn't think anything of it, really.
You guys must have had a...
We had a great time. I mean, you know, it's hard to explain what a wonderful feeling it was, not only to have the voice of your generation playing, singing in your ear while you're playing, but also just to, have that ability to get what you do out there. You know, that's really where it's at.
How is One to One received? I mean, first of all, you guys must have been thrilled. You're playing in the Garden.
Oh, I mean, it was amazing. We were playing, you know, at Madison Square Garden with John Lennon. It was just an amazing thing. It was, again, almost as good as my first son.
So, but what's the set that you're playing? You're not playing, are you playing something?
Okay, well, you know, it's interesting because we tried to get John to play a Beatles song. And he wouldn't, but we finally got him to agree to play Come Together. So that was the only Beatles song we did.
Why did he resist so?
Well, because he was trying to, shed that Beatle image. He wasn't, he wanted to be John Lennon. He didn't want to be a Beatle anymore. They were all striking out on their own, and they all had to get away from that somewhat. Of course, they would always be Beatles, but when John and Paul were together, it was magic. I mean, let's face it, there was the songwriting team, just amazing. And once they left, they were different. You know, Paul had his style and John had his style. Putting them together, there was greatness. But separate, they were different. They weren't the Beatles anymore, so they needed to really establish themselves as solo artists, I believe. That's why John didn't want to do any Beatles songs. So we did Sometime in New York City, we did Mother, we did Imagine, we did...
Cold Turkey, right?
What? Oh.
Did you do Cold Turkey?
Yes, we did, actually. We did Cold Turkey, everything.
But you did Sisters Are Sisters?
Or? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, yes. And we did... Okay, here's what happened. So we did New York City, and then Yoko would sing one of her songs, and as I told you, everything would come down, and then we would do another John Lennon song. So unfortunately, the people didn't like Yoko's songs. At the beginning of the concert, they passed out tambourines so everybody could play along, and during the first Yoko song, everybody threw their tambourines at the stage. So that was a little embarrassing. The show went on. But yeah, there was always criticism of Yoko, and there was always resistance to her, no matter what.
Unfair or fair?
I'd say some of it was unfair. She wasn't as bad a person as people think.
How would the critics receive the show? I mean, because you guys were looking at that show as kind of like almost dress rehearsal for going out on tour.
Right. Yes, this was supposed to be our first show of a national tour. The reviews were great for us as a band. Talking about Tex and myself and Stan as soloists and blah, 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 how great the... And unfortunately, the critics were very tough on John and Yoko, and of course Yoko. But I think they were tough on him just because he was giving Yoko, the venue to become a star. I think that's really what everybody's anger was about.
How were they tough? In what way?
Well, they were tougher on him because of Yoko than they ever were when he was a Beatle. And let's face it, everything the Beatles did was gold. All of a sudden, John wasn't gold anymore.
But the reviews themselves were vicious.
Yeah, they were very tough on him. In fact, I remember... after the concert, we didn't see him for a week after the reviews came out. He was very upset. Very upset. Yeah. It's hard. There are a couple of things I learned working with John as a young, because I was only about 25 myself, 26. And first thing I learned was that the hardest thing is not making it. It's maintaining your position on top. You can make it. But what do you have to keep you there and to maintain that stardom and that celebrity? That's the hard thing, because everybody's going to go downhill at some point. And you know that. It has to be. When is that going to be? That's the only thing that you can try to control.
And do you think that doubt was starting to creep into John?
Absolutely.
Talk to me about
it. Okay. Another thing I learned from John was how insecure he was. He would sit sometimes on the floor of the studio against the wall and tell us stories about how he couldn't get on stage. He was so insecure, he didn't want to perform. He felt terrible. He didn't. He thought everything he did was crap. And I started to think, my God, this guy's a Beatle. He's 31. I'm a kid of 25. Where am I going? You know, if a Beatle is this depressed, you know, what is there out there?
But he wrote about it too.
He did write about it. But you know, until you what's the word I'm looking for?
Intersect with him.
Interact on a personal level. You can hear about all the from the songs about Cold Turkey and Mother, but until you actually experience it, you don't really understand how badly he felt. But that's what made him a great rock and roller too. That's what made him a great singer, a rock singer. If you hear a great rock singer, you're going to hear a lot of pain in there. You have to hear pain.
So give me some sense of, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it yet, this is the third piece of the equation, which is one of the after effects or the sort of fallouts of being associated with Jerry is that Nixon starts to pay attention to John in America.
Yeah.
Give me some sense, if you can, first of Jerry, Rubin, Abby Hoffman. Are they the kind of, let's just put a flower out, let's be peace and loving, let's, incremental change, and we'll eventually turn things around, but it may take a couple generations, but we're going to, love is the answer.
Well, another thing I learned is that people always have an agenda. You know, whether it's peace, war, love, hate, people have an agenda. And not everyone needs attention and adoration, but unfortunately, sometimes we get into a position where that becomes a byproduct of it, and then we get really caught up in the byproducts more so than what we were actually speaking about when we started out. I think the movement, of course, was very important to Jerry and those guys, but they were always also able to use it to further themselves as individuals.
But they were real radicals.
They were very radical. But, you know, they didn't blow anything up. They made some noise. They stopped some traffic. But we also knew, you know, the SDS people and the weathermen. And these people were really blowing stuff up. I mean, when we played down in Washington, we stayed at Leslie Bacon's house. And I remember a couple of years later, we reading the papers, oh, look, Leslie's been arrested by the feds, you know, they finally got her. So, you know, we were used to real radicals. I mean, you know, we didn't blow anything up, but we played the soundtrack.
You know? That's great. Okay.
All right.
But I guess one of the things that I think is important is, you know, Jerry's talking about real revolution. I mean, whether he's serious or not, he stands up and he's fine.
Who, Jerry?
Yeah.
Jerry, Abby Hoffman, they were revolutionaries. They wanted revolution. This country was not going to allow it, though. No way this country, or Nixon and Hoover, were going to allow revolution. I mean, we really believed that we could do something, that we could take over and make a difference.
And how did John fit into that equation when he arrived in New York?
John fit in because he was the most visible spokesman in the world for the movement at that point, or best and most well-known.
You're going to ride his coattails to revolution, right?
There you go. That's what I saw.
What?
Well, I saw that, you know, the revolution needed someone like John Lennon to get the message out across the entire country. The tour was to be a get-out-the-vote tour. That's what was scary to the government. It was scary to Nixon, because he was still, I believe, in his first term then. And it was scary to Hoover because everything scared him. You know, that wasn't...
Alderman and Ehrlich.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right, so is John that kind of a revolutionary? Is he truly that kind of a radical?
No. John wanted radical change. But even as he says in Revolution, you know, you say you want a revolution. Oh, well, whatever the lyrics are. I wasn't a Beatle fan.
Right? You can what?
Yeah, right. If you're on, there you go. It's just what I said.
Exactly. No, but seriously, is John that kind?
John would not blow things up. John was a pacifist. John was not a warmonger or a hate monger. John was a pacifist who was a humanitarian. He wanted people to live in peace.
But he gets associated with Jerry and Abby and everybody else. And how does Nixon see him?
Nixon sees John as the voice of the revolution, the unifying voice of the revolution. Because you had Jerry and Abby, and you had the SDS, and you had the Weathermen. But if they could all come together under one God and call that John Lennon, and that would have brought the revolution, I believe, to another level. Maybe we were dreaming. Maybe we would never be able to pull it off. But at that point, they thought so, and we thought so.
So what did he tell you about the immigration problems or the FBI? Did he say, hey?
Well, we always knew they were around, you know, because that's just the way it was. I mean, we knew about it because we were already, you know, attached to the movement. So there were always people around, you know, whether they were undercover or obvious, they were around. They were always around. And, you know, we found out later on that, you know, everybody had FBI files because of John and because of the movement. That's just the way it was. You know, it didn't even matter in those days. Everybody had a file, you know.
You wanted a file.
Well, I guess, you know, you were cool. Hey, man, I got a file, you know,
right.
Cool.
If you didn't have a file, you
yeah, who are you? Right, yeah.
I wanted a file. I was five. Right?
Yeah, he wanted to be against whatever they were for. Yeah, I mean it was a rough time in American history. You know, lots of things happened.
So you have John, I think genuinely spooked by the spooks. I mean, I think that he seems to have been really taken by the fact that the full weight of the U.S. government is trying to deport him, get him out of the country. Sometime in New York City. Maybe a great album with a great band behind it, but it flops. And the concert is not well received by the critics.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me about each of those three elements and what they do to John's psychology, his psyche?
Well, as things kept building up against him and more roadblocks came up, he got more and more depressed, more and more frustrated.
Drank?
Oh, yeah. Well, look. There were a lot of drugs around in those days. So, you know, we were in the music business. There were a lot of drugs. Yes, we did drink. We drank a lot of tequila, Remy Martin. They were wild times, you know. It was part of the culture then. So, yes, he did drink. He did a lot of drugs. He did drink. But he was really frustrated. He was frustrated by not being able to play, not being able to work, and not being able to get his message out. And I think that led to his unraveling and wound up, you know, sending him off to California where he got, you know, totally crazy and then came back and did nothing for 5 years.
You know, that sense that, you know, somebody said to me, John was not a happy drunk.
No, he wasn't. No, he wasn't. But, you know, I've worked with a lot of not happy drunks. You know, you kind of get used to it, I guess.
So that night that Nixon got reelected, were you performing in the studio that night? You guys were doing approximately Infinite Universe, right? You were working.
Yeah, we were actually, right. That was a couple of months in that, October, November, right.
Do you remember that night of Nixon's reelection?
I remember. The one thing I remember, you know, obviously we were all anxious about the results, and I remember we got the results, and I never saw John that depressed. He was really, really down. You know, it was like we needed Nixon out. He wanted Nixon out. Everybody wanted Nixon out. And
but he got something more on the line, right? He's got his deportation.
Oh, yeah, he had everything on it. I mean, Nixon was out to get him. No doubt about it. Nixon and Hoover were out to squash him because he was, unfortunately for him, telling the truth about what was going on, and they didn't really want the truth to get out at that point. I mean, you know, we know going back about Hanoi and Cambodia, and, you know, what was actually happening. In those days, nobody knew. We thought, but nobody actually knew.
So what is Nixon's reelection? Give give me a sense of how the news hits. Do you hear just like, oh, we won?
Oh, no. Well, we found out, I think, at the studio, if I remember correctly. We found out that he won, and I think that was the end of the session. It was just totally deflated everybody. We all got very depressed. John particularly was, you know, he took it very personally. Because I think that he saw the ousting of Nixon as his being able to be reborn, you know, and get out there and tour and work, which is what he wanted to do. He's a musician. He's a performer. That's what performers want to do more than anything.
Did he sit in a corner and cry?
Well, I wouldn't say he sat in a corner and cried, but he was very depressed. We all kind of sat down and, like, we were in awe. And we were, you know, couldn't believe it. What? Nixon won again? No. You know, by a lot, yeah. Well, that's a whole other thing, you know. He sold crime and, you know.
Yeah, that's a different story.
Yeah, different story.
So, but, you know, sit up? Yeah, sure. Do you mind?
You want me to sit up now? Jeez.
Left? Move your chair to your left. Sorry. We're just.
I don't know. Is that okay with continuity?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, there is no continuity. Not that much. Too much?
Too much?
Okay.
Good?
Yeah. Mike, he's going to go back this one. That's where it was. All right. Okay. So, you know, I've heard different pieces of that John drank, that everybody was drunk that night. Did you go to Jerry's apartment after the studio, or did you go home?
Now, I don't remember going. I've talked to people who said I did go. I don't remember, honestly. You know, it was the 60s and 70s. I don't remember. I don't think I was there, but I've been told I was there. So I couldn't give you any information. Sorry.
I like that you were told that you were there. Yeah. That's good. I like that. eventually, you know, John goes to, she kicks him out.
Yeah.
And your relationship.
I remember Gary said something about he took a groupie into the room. I thought it was May Pang.
No.
Was it?
No.
Okay.
But Gary wasn't there either, right? He left early.
No, he was there too. That's how I knew I was there. He told me I was there.
Well, he tells me his wife got drunk and he left early.
Right.
Nobody wants to be in that. Why? You know, nobody wants to be there that night.
Right. It was depressing. Everybody was depressed. You know, everybody's angry. You know.
Right.
We were very, you know, everybody was very, very upset. It was depressing. Everybody was, you know, you couldn't even talk. That's all you could talk about.
I'm going to fast forward.
Yeah, go ahead.
If I can, to December of 1980.
Okay.
You're in New York.
Right.
You're living in Brooklyn.
Right.
That night?
The night before, I think I was in the studio doing something, because at that point I was just a studio musician. And I had a son, and I remember, you know, going home, going to sleep, and my son would wake up with me, so we would, like, sleep till noon, you know. And he was a baby, but he kind of got into the music hours. So we wake up at noon. I turn on news at noon. That was my routine. And it said John Lennon was killed. I couldn't believe it. I felt like somebody kicked me in the stomach. You know, and I didn't think, you know, 5 years later or whatever that I was, you know, it was going to affect me so much. Or, you know, I really hadn't thought about it. But thinking about it at that point, I was really surprised at how much it bothered me. Why was I surprised?
Why did it bother you?
Why did it bother me? Well, you know, when you know somebody, it hurts more. When you realize, you know, that the guy had only good to give, it hurts even more. Yeah, he had his problems. He had his foibles. He was a lousy drunk. He, you know, he was moody sometimes. But it's part of the nature of the beast, you know.
So what did you do? What was your, do you remember that moment?
That moment, I was in shock, and I, you know, again, my son was very young; he was only a couple of months old, and we just sat there listening to the radio all day, and listening to Beatles song after, you know, and just trying to take it in, and it was very difficult to take in.
Did you ever make sense of it?
Well, the only sense that you can make of it, we live in a crazy society where, you know, if you want to be a celebrity, you go out to do something stupid. You know.
And even if you're a fucking lunatic, you can buy a gun.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's usually the first
question.
Right. Are you out of your mind? Yes. Okay, good.
There you go. Right. And you promised to use this against somebody.
Absolutely.